Encouraged by their success at Balaclava, the next day the Russians launched an attack on the right flank of the British army on Cossack Mountain, a V-shaped ridge of undulating uplands, 2.5 kilometres in length, running north to south between the eastern sector of Sevastopol and the Chernaya estuary, known to the British as Mount Inkerman. On the 26th of October, 5,000 Russian troops under Colonel Fedorov marched east out of Sevastopol, turned right to climb Cossack Mountain, and descended on the unsuspecting soldiers of de Lacy Evans's 2nd Division, encamped at the southern end of the high plateau, at a place called Home Ridge, where the heights sloped steeply down onto the Balaclava Plain. Evans had only 2,600 troops at his disposal, the rest of his division being elsewhere on trench duty, but the outlying pickets at Shell Hill held off the Russians with their Minier rifles, while Evans brought up more artillery, installing 18 guns in positions out of sight. Drawing the enemy onto their artillery, the British dispersed them with a devastating fire that left several hundred Russians dead and wounded on the scrubland before Home Ridge. More were taken prisoner, many of them giving themselves up or deserting to the British side. They brought dreadful tales of the conditions in Sevastopol, where there was a shortage of water and the hospitals were overrun with victims of the bombing, as well as cholera. A German officer who was serving with the Russians told the British that they were obliged to come out of Sevastopol on account of the disgraceful smell that was in the town, and his opinion was that the town would soon fall into the hands of the British as the killed and wounded was laying in the streets. According to Godfrey Moseley, paymaster of the 20th Regiment, "The army that came out of Sevastopol to attack the other day were all drunk. The hospitals smelt so bad with them that you could not remain more than a minute in the place, and we were told by an officer who they took prisoner that they had been giving them wine till they had got them to the proper pitch and asked who would go out and drive the English dogs into the sea, instead of which we drove them back into the town with a loss of about 700 in a very short time. The same officer told us that we might have got into the town when we first came here easily, but now we should have some difficulty." In truth, the attack by the Russians was really a reconnaissance in force for a major new assault against the British forces on the heights of Inkerman. The initiative from the assault came from the Tsar, who had learned of Napoleon's intention to send more troops to the Crimea and believed that Menshikov should use his numerical superiority to break the siege as soon as possible, before the French reinforcements arrived, or at least to impose a delay on the Allies until winter came to the rescue of the Russians. "I have two generals who will not fail me, Generals January and February," Nicholas said, adopting the old cliché of 1812. By the 4th of November, the Russians had been reinforced by the arrival of two infantry divisions of the 4th Corps from Bessarabia, the 10th Division under Lieutenant General Soymanov, and the 11th under Lieutenant General Pavlov, bringing the total force at Menshikov's disposal to 107,000 men, not including the sailors. At first, Menshikov had been opposed to the idea of a new offensive. He was still inclined to abandon Sevastopol to the enemy, but the Tsar was adamant and even sent his sons, the Grand Dukes Mikhail and Nikolai, to encourage the troops and to enforce his will. Under pressure, Menshikov agreed to attack, believing that the British were a less formidable opponent than the French. If the Russians could establish themselves with artillery batteries on Mount Inkerman, the Allied siege lines on the right would find themselves under fire from behind, and unless they recaptured the heights, the Allies would be forced to abandon the siege. For all the Russians' losses, their sortie of the 26th of October had revealed the weakness of the British defences on Mount Inkerman. Raglan had been warned on a number of occasions by de Lacy Evans and Burgoyne that these crucial heights were vulnerable and needed to be occupied in strength and fortified. Bosquet, the commander of an infantry division on the Sapone Heights to the south of Inkerman, had been adding his own warnings in almost daily letters to the British commander, while Canrobert had even offered immediate help. But Raglan had done nothing to strengthen the defences, even after the sortie by the Russians, when the French commander was amazed to learn that so important and so exposed a position had been left totally unprotected by fortifications. It was not just negligence that lay behind Raglan's failure, but a calculated risk. The British were too few in number to protect all their positions. They were seriously overstretched and would have been incapable of repulsing a general attack if one had been launched at several points along their line. By the first week of November, the British infantry were exhausted. They had scarcely had a rest since their landing in the Crimea, as Private Henry Smith recalled in a letter to his parents in February 1855. "After the Battle of the Alma and the march to Balaclava, we were immediately put to work, starting from the 24th of September, during which we never got more than 4 hours' sleep out of 24, and very often did not get as much time even as to make a tin of coffee before we were sent on some other duty, till the siege opened on the 14th of October, and although shot and shell fell like hail, as from the dreadful fatigue we had to undergo, we were so regardless as to lie down and sleep even at the mouth of the cannon. We were often being 24 hours in the trenches, and I believe there was not an hour's drying in the 24, so that when we came to camp we were wet to the skin and all over mud even to the shoulders. And in this very state we had to march to Inkerman battle without as much as a bit of bread or a sip of water to satisfy a craving hunger and thirst." Menshikoff's plan was a more ambitious version of the sortie on the 26th of October, Little Inkerman as that dress rehearsal later became known. On the afternoon of the 4th of November, only a few hours after the arrival of the 4th Corps from Bessarabia, he ordered the offensive to begin at 6 o'clock the next morning. Soymanov was to lead a force of 19,000 men and 38 guns along the same route taken on the 26th of October. Capturing Shell Hill, they were to be joined there by Pavlov's force, 16,000 men and 96 guns, which was to cross the Chernaya River and ascend the heights from the Inkerman Bridge. Under General Dannenberg, who was to take over the command at this point, the combined force was to drive the British off Mount Inkerman, while Leprandi's army distracted Bosquet's corps on the Sapun Heights. The plan called for a high degree of coordination between the attacking units, which was too much to expect from any army in an age before the radio, let alone from the Russians, who lacked detailed maps. It also called for a change of commander in the middle of the battle, a recipe for disaster, especially since Dannenberg, a veteran of the Napoleonic Wars, had a record of defeat and indecisiveness that was hardly likely to inspire men. But the biggest flaw of all was the whole idea that a force of 35,000 men and 134 guns could even be deployed on the narrow ridge that was Shell Hill, a rocky piece of scrubland barely 300 metres wide. Realising its impracticality, Dannenberg began to change the battle plan at the last minute. Late at night, on the 4th of November, he ordered Soymanov's men not to climb Mount Inkerman from the northern side as had been planned, but to march east as far as the Inkerman Bridge to cover Pavlov's crossing of the river. From the bridge, the attacking forces were to climb the heights in three different directions and round on the British from the flanks. The sudden change was confusing, but even more confusion was to come. At 3 o'clock in the morning, Soymanov's column was moving east from Sevastopol towards Mount Inkerman when he received another message from Dannenberg, ordering him to march in the opposite direction and attack from the west. Thinking that another change of plan would endanger the whole operation, Soymanov ignored the order, but instead of meeting Pavlov at the bridge, he now went back to his own preferred plan of attacking from the north. The three commanders thus went into the Battle of Inkerman with entirely different plans. By 5 o'clock in the morning, Soymanov's advance guard had climbed the heights in silence from the northern side with 22 field guns. There had been heavy rain for the past 3 days. The steep slopes were slippery with mud. Men and horses struggled with the heavy guns. The rain had stopped that night, and there was now a heavy fog that shrouded their ascent from the enemy outposts. The fog covered us, recalled Captain Andrianov. We could see no further than a few feet ahead of us. The dampness chilled our bones. The dense fog was to play a crucial role in the fighting that lay ahead. Soldiers could not see their senior commanders, whose orders became virtually irrelevant. They relied instead on their own company officers, and when these disappeared, they had to take the lead themselves, fighting on their own or alongside those comrades they could see through the fog in a largely improvised fashion. This was to be a soldier's battle, the ultimate test of a modern army. Everything depended on the cohesion of the small unit, and every man became his own general. In the opening hours, the fog played into the hands of the Russians. It covered their approach and brought them to within close range of the British positions, eliminating the disadvantage of their muskets and artillery against the longer range of the Minié rifles. The British pickets on Shell Hill were unaware of the Russians approaching. They had taken shelter from the bad weather by moving to the bottom of the hill, from which they could see nothing. The warning sounds of an army on the march that had been heard earlier in the night failed to trigger the appropriate alarms. Private Bloomfield was on picket duty on Mount Inkerman that night and could hear the sounds of Sevastopol stirring for something. The bells of the churches had been ringing intermittently throughout the night, but he could not see a thing. There was a great fog, so much that we could not see a man 10 yards away from us, and nearly all the night there was a drizzly rain, Bloomfield recalled. All went well until about midnight, when some of our sentries reported wheels and noise like the unloading of shot and shell, but the field officer on duty took no further notice of it. All the night from about 9 o'clock in the evening, the bells were ringing and the bands were playing, and a great noise was all over the town. Before they knew it, the pickets at Shell Hill were overrun by Soymanov's skirmishers, and then, fast upon them, emerging from the fog, were the advance columns of his infantry. 6,000 men from the Kolovansky, Ekaterinburg and Tomsky regiments. The Russians established their guns on Shell Hill and began to push the British back. "When we retired, the Russians came on with the most fiendish yells you can imagine," recalled Captain Hugh Rowlands in charge of the picket, who withdrew his men to the next high ground and ordered them to open fire, only to discover that their rifles would not work because their charges had been soaked by rain. The sound of firing at last sounded the alarm in the camp of the 2nd Division, where soldiers rushed about in their underwear, getting dressed and folding up their tents before grabbing their rifles and falling into line. "There was a good deal of hurry and confusion," recalled George Carmichael of the Derbyshire Regiment. "A number of loose baggage animals, frightened by the firing, came galloping through the camp, and the men who had been away on different duties came running in to join the ranks." The command was taken up by General Pennefather, second in command to De Lacy Evans, who had earlier been injured falling from his horse but was present in an advisory capacity. Pennefather chose a different tactic to the one employed by Evans on the 26th of October. Instead of falling back to draw the enemy onto the guns behind Home Ridge, he continued feeding the picket line with riflemen to keep the Russians as far back as possible until reinforcements could arrive. Pennefather did not know that the division was outnumbered by the Russians by more than 6-1, but his tactic rested on the hope that the thick fog would conceal his lack of numbers from the enemy. Pennefather's men bravely held off the Russians, fighting forward in small groups, separated from each other by fog and smoke. They were too far ahead to be seen by Pennefather, let alone controlled by him, or to be supported with any precision by the 2 field batteries at Home Ridge, which fired blindly in the vague direction of the enemy. Sheltering with his regiment behind the British guns, Carmichael watched the gunners do their best to keep up with the vastly superior firepower of the Russian batteries. "They fired, I should imagine, at the flash of the enemy's guns on Shell Hill, and drew a heavy fire on themselves in return. Some of the gunners fell, and we also suffered, although we had been ordered to lie down to obtain what shelter we could from the ridge. One round shot, I remember, tore into my company, completely severing the left arm and both legs off a man in the front rank, and killed his rear rank man without any perceptible wound. Other casualties were also occurring in other companies. The guns were firing as fast as they could load, and each successive discharge and recoil brought them closer to our line. We assisted the gunners to run the guns into their first position, and some men also aided in carrying ammunition. The main thing at this stage was to keep the noise of the barrage up, to make the Russians think that the British had more guns than they actually had, pass the ammunition and wait for reinforcements to arrive. If Soymanov had known the weakness of the British defences, he would have ordered Home Ridge to be stormed, but he could see nothing in the fog, and the heavy firing of the enemy, whose Minier rifles were deadly accurate at the short range from which the British fired, persuaded him to wait for Pavlov's men to join him on Shell Hill before launching an assault. Within minutes, Soymanov himself was killed by a British rifleman. The command was taken up by Colonel Pristovoitov, who was shot a few minutes later, and then by Colonel Yuvashnov Alexandrov, who was also killed. After that, it was not clear who would take up the command. Nobody was keen to step up to the mark, and Captain Andrianov was sent off on his horse to consult with various generals on the matter, which wasted valuable time. Meanwhile, at 5 a.m., Pavlov's men had arrived at the Inkerman Bridge, only to discover that the naval detachment had not prepared it for their crossing, as they had been ordered to by Dannenberg. They had to wait until 7 o'clock before the bridge was ready and they could cross the Chernaya. From there they fanned out and climbed the heights in three different directions. The Okhotsky, Yakutsky and Selenginsky regiments and most of the artillery branching to the right to reach the top by the Sapper Road and join Soymanov's men. The Borodinsky ascending by the centre route along the Volovia Ravine, while the Tarutinsky regiment climbed the steep and rocky slopes of the Quarry Ravine towards the sandbag battery under cover of Soymanov's guns. There were fierce gun battles across the heights, small groups of fighters dashing everywhere, using the thick bushes to conceal themselves and fire at each other like skirmishers. But the most intense was on the British right flank around the sandbag battery. 20 minutes after they had crossed the bridge, the advance battalions of the Tarutinsky regiment overpowered the small picket in the battery, but then came under a series of attacks from a combined British force of 700 men under the command of Brigadier Adams. In frenzied hand-to-hand fighting, the sandbag battery changed sides several times. By 8 o'clock, Adams's men were outnumbered by the Russians 10-1, but because of the narrow ridge on which the fighting for the battery took place, the Russians could not make their numbers tell in one assault. Once the British had regained the battery, the Russians came at them again in a series of attacks. Private Edward Hyde was in the battery with Adams's men. "The Russian infantry got right up to it and clambered up the front and sides of it, and we had a hard job to keep them out. Directly we saw their heads above the parapet or looking into the embrasures, we fired at them or bayoneted them as fast as we could. They came on like ants. No sooner was one knocked backwards than another clambered over the dead bodies to take his place, all of them yelling and shouting. We in the battery were not quiet, you may be sure, and what with the cheering and shouting, the thud of blows, the clash of bayonets and swords, the ping of the bullets, the whistling of the shells, the foggy atmosphere and the smell of powder and blood, the scene inside the battery where we were was beyond the power of man to imagine or describe. Eventually, the Russians could no longer be held back. They swarmed into the battery, and Adams and his men were forced to retreat towards Home Ridge, but reinforcements soon arrived, the Duke of Cambridge with the Grenadiers, and a new assault was launched against the Russians grouped around the sandbag battery, which by this stage had assumed a symbolic status far beyond its military significance to either side. The Grenadiers charged the Russians with their bayonets, Cambridge shouting at his men to keep to the high ground and not become dispersed by following the Russians down the hill, but few men could hear the Duke or see him in the fog. Among the Grenadiers was George Higginson, who witnessed the charge, "down the rugged slope, full upon the advancing host." The exultant cheer confirmed my dread that our gallant fellows would soon get out of hand, and, in fact, except for one short period during the long day when we contrived to make some kind of regular formation, the contest was maintained by groups under company officers who were unable, owing to the mist and smoke of musketry fire, to preserve any definite touch. The fighting became increasingly frenzied and chaotic as one side charged the other down the hill, only to be counterattacked by another group of men from further up the hill. The soldiers on both sides lost all discipline and became disordered mobs, uncontrolled by any officers and driven on by rage and fear, reinforced by the fact that they could not see each other in the fog. They charged and countercharged, yelling and screaming, firing their guns, slashing out in all directions with their swords, and when they had no ammunition left, they began throwing rocks at one another, striking out with their rifle butts, even kicking and biting. In this sort of fighting, the cohesion of the small combat unit was decisive. Everything came down to whether groups of men and their line commanders could keep their discipline and unity, whether they could organize themselves and stick together through the fight without losing nerve or running away out of fear. The soldiers of the Tarutinsky regiment failed this crucial test. Chodasiewicz was one of the company officers in the 4th Battalion of the Tarutinsky regiment. Their task was to take the eastern side of Mount Inkerman, providing cover for Pavlov's other troops to bring up gabions and fascines for a trench work against the British positions. The unit lost its way in the thick fog, veered towards the left, and became mixed with disgruntled soldiers from the Ekaterinburg regiment among Soymanov's troops already on the heights, who led them back down into the quarry. By this stage, Chodasiewicz had lost control of his men, who were totally dispersed among the Ekaterinburg regiment. Undirected by the officers, some of the Tarutinsky men began to climb the hill again. Ahead of them, they could make out some of their comrades, standing before a small battery, shouting hurrah and waving their caps for us to come on, recalled Chodasiewicz. The buglers continually played the advance, and several of my men broke from the ranks at a run. At the sandbag battery, Chodasiewicz found his men in total disorder. Various regiments were all mixed up, so that their command structures entirely broke down. He ordered his men to charge with bayonets, and they overran the British in the battery, but then they failed to push them down the hill, remaining instead inside the battery, where they forgot their duty and wandered about in search of booty, recalled another officer, who thought all this occurred because of a lack of officers and leadership. With all the fog and mixing up of men, there were many instances of friendly fire on the Russian side. Soymanov's troops, in particular the Ekaterinburg regiment, began firing at the men inside the sandbag battery, some thinking they were firing on the enemy, others on the order of an officer who feared the insubordination of his men and tried to discipline them by having others shoot at them. "The chaos was something extraordinary," recalled Chodasiewicz. "Some of the men were grumbling at the Ekaterinburg regiment, others were shouting for artillery to come up. The buglers constantly played the signal to advance and drummers beat to the attack, but nobody thought of moving. There they stood like a flock of sheep." A bugle call to maneuver left caused a sudden panic among the Tarutinsky men, who thought that they could hear the distant noise of the French drums. "There were shouts on all sides of, 'Where is the reserve?'" recalled an officer. Fearing they had no support, the troops began to stampede down the hill. According to Chodasiewicz, "officers shouted to the men to halt, but to no avail, for none of them thought of stopping, but each followed the direction prompted by his fancy or his fears. No officer, however senior, was able to reverse the panic retreat of the men, who ran down to the bottom of the quarry ravine and crowded around the Sevastopol aqueduct, which alone stopped their flight. When Lieutenant General Kiryakov, the commander of the 17th Infantry Division who had gone absent at the Alma, appeared at the aqueduct and rode among the men on his white charger, slashing at them with his whip and shouting at them to climb back up the hill, The soldiers paid him little attention and then shouted back at him, "Go up there yourself!" Chodasyevich was ordered to collect his company, but he had only 45 men left out of a company of 120. The Tarutinsky men had not been wrong when they thought they could hear the sound of the French drums. Raglan had sent an urgent call for help to Bosquet on the Sapun Heights at 7 a.m. after he had arrived to inspect the battle at Home Ridge. He had also sent an order for two heavy 18-pounder cannon to be brought up from the siege batteries to counter the Russian cannonade, but the order had gone astray. Bosquet's men had already sensed that the British were in danger when they heard the early firing. The Zouaves had even heard the Russians on the march the night before, their African experience having taught them how to listen to the ground, and they were ready for the order to attack before it came. Nothing suited their type of fighting better than the foggy conditions and bushy scrubland of the hills. They were used to mountain warfare from Algeria and were at their best when fighting in small groups and ambushing the enemy. The Zouaves and Chasseurs were eager to advance, but Bosquet held them back, fearful of Liprandi's army, 22,000 soldiers and 88 field guns in the South Valley under the command of Gorchakov, which had begun a distant cannonade against the Sapun Heights. "Forward! Let's march! It's time to finish them!" the Zouaves cried impatiently when Bosquet appeared among their ranks. They were angry when the general walked before them. "A revolt was imminent," recalled Louis Noir, who was in the first column of Zouaves. "The deep respect and true affection which we felt for Bosquet were tested to the limit by the impetuosity of the old Algerian bands. Suddenly, Bosquet turned and drew his sword, placed himself at the head of his Zouaves, his Turks and Chasseurs, undefeated troops he had known for years, and, pointing his sword toward the 20,000 Russian troops amassed on the redoubts of the opposing heights, shouted in a thunderous voice, 'En avant! À la bayonette!'" In fact, the size of Liprandi's army was not as large as Bosquet had feared, since Gorchakov had foolishly decided to position half of them behind the Chernaya River in reserve and had dispersed the rest between the lower slopes of the Sapun Heights and the Sandbag Battery. But the Zouaves did not know this. They could not see their enemy in the thick fog, and attacked with fearsome energy to overcome what they believed to be their disadvantage in numbers. Charging forward in small groups and using the brushwood for cover while they fired at the Russian columns, their tactic was to scare the Russians off by any means they could. They yelled and screamed and fired in the air as they ran forward. Their bugles sounded and their drummers beat as loud as they could. Jean Clair, a colonel of the 2nd Zouave Regiment, even told his men as they prepared to go into battle, "Spread out your pants as wide as they will go, and make as big a show of yourselves as you can." The Russians were overwhelmed by the attacking force of the Zouaves, whose Minier rifles took out hundreds of men within the first few seconds of their charge. Racing up the hill bend round Home Ridge, the Zouaves drove the Russians from the Sandbag Battery and chased them down to the bottom of St. Clement's Ravine. Their momentum took them around the curving spur into Quarry Ravine, already heaving with the soldiers of the Tarutinsky Regiment, who began to panic in the crush and fired back at the new arrivals, killing mainly their own men, before the Zouaves backed out of the crossfire and climbed towards Home Ridge. There they found the British in desperate battle with the forces on the right wing of Pavlov's pincer movement, the Okhotsky, Yakutsky and Selenginsky regiments, who had joined the remnants of Soymanov's troops and, under the command of Dannenberg, began to attack the Sandbag Battery again. The fighting was brutal. Wave after wave of Russians charged with their bayonets, only to be shot down by the British or tussle with them, hand to hand, foot to foot, muzzle to muzzle, butt end to butt end, recalled Captain Wilson of the Coldstream Guards. The Guards were vastly outnumbered by the Russians and in urgent need of reinforcements when they were at last joined by 6 companies of Cathcart's 4th Division under the command of General Torrance. The new men were spoiling for a fight, They had missed out on the action at Balaclava and the Alma, and, ordered to attack the Russians on the ridge by the sandbag battery, they charged down the valley after them, losing all discipline and coming under heavy, close-range fire by the Yakutsky and Selenginsky regiments from the heights above. Among those killed in the hail of bullets was Cathcart, the spot where he was buried becoming known as Cathcart's Hill. By this stage, Cambridge and the guards were down to their last 100 men in the sandbag battery. There were 2,000 Russians against them. They had no ammunition left. The Duke proposed to make a stand for the sandbag battery, an idiotic sacrifice for this relatively minor landmark on the battlefield, but his staff officers dissuaded him. It would be disastrous for the Queen's cousin and the colours of her guards to be brought before the Tsar. Among those officers was Higginson, who led the retreat to Home Ridge. "Clustered round the colours," he recalled, "the men passed slowly backwards, keeping their front full towards the enemy, their bayonets ready at the charge. As a comrade fell, wounded or dead, his fellow took his place and maintained the compactness of the gradually diminishing group that held on with unflinching stubbornness in protecting the flags. Happily, the ground on our right was so precipitous as to deter the enemy from attempting to outflank us on that side, as from time to time some Russian soldiers, more adventurous than their fellows, sprang forwards towards our compact group. Two or three of our grenadiers would dash out with the bayonet and compel steady retreat. Nevertheless, our position was critical." It was at this moment that Bosquet's men appeared on the ridge. Never had the sight of Frenchmen been so welcome to the English. The guards cheered them as they arrived and cried, "Vive les Français!" and the French replied, "Vive les Anglais!" Stunned by the arrival of the French, the Russians withdrew to Shell Hill and attempted to consolidate, but the morale of their troops had dropped. They did not fancy their chances against the British and the French, and many of them now began to run away, using the cover of the fog to escape the attentions of their officers. For a while, Dannenberg believed that he could win with his artillery. He had nearly 100 guns, including 12-pound field guns and howitzers, more than the British at Home Ridge. But at 9:30, the two heavy 18-pounders ordered up by Raglan finally arrived and opened fire on Shell Hill, their monstrous charges blasting through the Russian batteries and forcing their artillery to withdraw from the field. The Russians were not finished. They had 6,000 men still to be used on the heights and twice that number in reserve on the other side of the river. Some of them continued to attack, but their advancing columns were ripped apart by the heavy British guns. Finally, Dannenberg decided to call off the action and retreat. He had to overcome the angry protests of Menshikov and the Grand Dukes, who had watched the slaughter from a safe position 500 metres behind Shell Hill, and called on Dannenberg to reverse the withdrawal. Dannenberg told Menshikov, "Highness, to stop the troops here would be to let them be destroyed to the last man. If your Highness thinks otherwise, have the goodness to give the orders yourself and take the command from me." The exchange was the beginning of a long and bitter argument between the two men, who could not stand each other, as each man tried to blame the other for the defeat at Inkerman, a battle where the Russians had vastly outnumbered the enemy. Menshikov blamed Dannenberg, and Dannenberg blamed Soymanov, who was dead, and everybody blamed the ordinary soldiers for their indiscipline and cowardice. But ultimately, the disorder came from the absence of command, and there the blame must rest with Menshikov, the commander-in-chief, who lost his nerve completely and took no part in the action. The Grand Duke Nikolai, who saw through Menshikov, wrote to his older brother Alexander, soon to become Tsar, "We, the two Grand Dukes, had been waiting for Prince Menshikov near the Inkerman Bridge, but he did not come out of his house until 6:30 a.m., when our troops had already taken the first position. We stayed with the prince all the time on the right flank, and not once did any of the generals send him a report on the course of the battle. The men were disordered because they were badly directed. The disorder originated from Menshikov. Staggering though it is to relate, Menshikov had no headquarters at all. just three people who work at those duties in such a fashion that, if you want to know something, you are at a loss to know whom to ask. Ordered to withdraw, the Russians fled in panic from the battlefield, their officers powerless to stop the human avalanche while the British and French artillery fired at their backs. "They were petrified," recalled a French officer. "It was no longer a battle, but a massacre." The Russians were mowed down in their hundreds, others trampled underfoot as they ran down the hill towards the bridge and struggled to cross it or swam across the river to the other side. Some of the French chased after them, and a dozen men or so from the Alomel Brigade even entered Sevastopol. They were carried away by the chase and unaware that they were on their own, the rest of the French having turned back long before. The streets of Sevastopol were virtually empty, for the whole population was on the battlefield or standing guard at the bastions. The Frenchmen walked around the town, looting houses, and made their way down to the quay, where their sudden appearance caused civilians to flee in panic, thinking that the enemy had broken through. The French soldiers were equally afraid. Hoping to escape by sea, they rowed off in the first boat they could find, but just as they were rounding Fort Alexander into the open sea, their boat was sunk by a direct hit from the quarantine battery. The story of the Alomel soldiers became an inspiration to the French army during the long siege, giving rise to the belief that Sevastopol could be taken with a single bold attack. Many thought their story showed that the Allied armies could and should have used the moment when the Russians were in flight from the heights of Inkerman to pursue them and march into the town as those audacious men had done. The Russians lost about 12,000 men on the battlefield of Inkerman. The British listed 2,610 casualties, the French 1,726. It was an appalling number killed in just 4 hours of fighting, a rate of loss almost on a par with the Battle of the Somme. The dead and wounded were piled on top of each other's bits of bodies, torn apart by shells lying everywhere. The war correspondent Nicholas Woods observed, "Some had their heads taken off at the neck, as if with an axe, others their legs gone from the hips, others their arms, and others again, who were hit in the chest or stomach, were literally as smashed as if they had been crushed in a machine. Across the path, side by side, lay five Russian guardsmen, who were all killed by one round shot as they advanced to charge the enemy. They lay on their faces, in the same attitude, with their muskets tightly grasped in both hands, and all had the same grim, painful frown on their faces." Louis Noir thought the Russian dead, who were mostly killed by bayonets, had a look of furious hatred captured at the moment of their death. Jean Clair also walked among the wounded and the dead. "Some were dying, but for the most part they were dead, lying pell-mell upon one another. There were arms upraised above the mass of yellow flesh, as if begging for pity. The dead who were lying on their back had generally thrust out their hands, either as if to ward off the danger or to beg for mercy. All of them had medals or little copper cases containing images of the saints on chains around their necks. Underneath the dead, there were men alive, wounded and then buried under bodies struck down later on. Sometimes, from the bottom of a heap," wrote André Damas, a French army chaplain, "one could hear men breathing still, but they lacked the strength to lift the weight of flesh and bones that pressed them down. If their faint moans were heard, long hours passed before they could be cleared." Major General Codrington of the Light Division was horrified by the scavengers who robbed the dead. "The most disgusting thing to feel is that the horrid plunderers, the prowlers of a battlefield, have been there. Pockets turned inside out, things cut to look for money, everything valuable systematically searched for, officers particularly stripped for their better clothes, with just something thrown over them," he wrote on the 9th of November. It took the Allies several days to bury all their dead and evacuate the wounded to field hospitals. The Russians took much longer. Menshikov had refused the Allied offer of a truce to clear the battlefield for fear that his troops would become demoralized and might even mutiny at the sight of so many dead and wounded on their side compared to the losses of the enemy. So the Russian dead and wounded lay there for several days and even weeks. Claire found four Russian wounded men alive at the bottom of the quarry ravine 12 days after the battle. The poor fellows were lying under a projecting rock, and when asked on what they had contrived to subsist all this time, they replied by pointing first to heaven, which had sent them water and inspired them with courage, and then to some fragments of mouldy black bread, which they had found in the pouches of the numerous dead who lay around them. Some of the dead were not found until 3 months later. They were at the bottom of Spring Ravine, where they were frozen stiff, looking much like dried-up mummies, according to Claire. The Frenchman was struck by the contrast he had noted between the Russian dead at the Alma, who had an appearance of health. Their clothing, underclothing, and shoes were clean and in good condition, and the dead at Inkerman, who wore a look of suffering and fatigue. As at the Alma, there were claims that the Russians had engaged in atrocities against the British and the French. It was said that they had robbed and killed the wounded on the ground, sometimes even mutilating their bodies. British and French soldiers put these actions down to the savagery of the Russian troops, who they said had been well primed with vodka. "They give no quarter," wrote Hugh Drummond of the Scots Guards to his father on the 8th of November, "and this should be represented, as it is a scandal to the world that Russia, professing to be a civilized power, should disgrace herself by such acts of barbarity." Describing the dastardly conduct of the Russian troops in his anonymous memoir, another British soldier wrote, "Aided by night, they emerge from the fog unexpectedly, like demons, panting with murderous intent, for fair fighting is not their aim. Blessed by inhuman priests, promised plunder to any amount, excited by ardent liquids, encouraged by two of their grand dukes. Drunk, maddened, every evil passion aroused, they rush wildly upon our soldiers. At Inkerman, we saw the Russian soldiery bayoneting, beating out the brains, jumping like fiends upon the lacerated bodies of the wounded allies wherever they could find them. The atrocities committed by the Russians have covered their nation with infamy and made them an example of horror and detestation to the whole world." But in fact, these actions had more to do with a sense of religious outrage. When Raglan and Canrobert wrote to Menshikov on the 7th of November to protest against the atrocities, the Russian commander-in-chief replied that the killings had been caused by the destruction of the Church of St. Vladimir at Khersonesos, the church built to consecrate the spot where the Grand Prince Vladimir had been baptized, converting Kievan Rus to Christianity, which had been pillaged and then used by the French troops as part of their siege works. The deep religious feeling of our troops had been wounded by the desecration of St. Vladimir, argued Menshikov in a letter approved by the Tsar, adding for good measure that the Russians had themselves been victims of a series of bloody retributions by the English troops on the battlefield of Inkerman. Some of these facts were admitted by César de Bazancourt, the official French historian of the expedition to the Crimea, in his account of 1856. "Close upon the seashore, amid the irregular ground upon which stand the remnants of the Genoese fort, and which descends towards the Quarantine Bay, rose the small chapel of St. Vladimir. Some scattered soldiers, more bold than the others, would often creep through the undulations of the ground towards the quarantine establishments which had been abandoned by the Russians, and carry off thence anything serviceable to them, either to shelter themselves or to feed the fires in front of their tents, firewood beginning to be scarce. To these soldiers, already culpable, succeeded those marauders who, in every army, will prowl about in contempt of all laws and all discipline, in search of pillage. They contrived to get beyond the line of outposts, and penetrated during the night into the small chapel placed under the guardianship of the protecting saint of Russia." but if the Russians had been driven to atrocities by deep religious feelings, it was certainly the case that they had been encouraged by their priests. The night before the battle, at services in churches in Sevastopol, the Russian troops were told that the British and the French were fighting for the devil, and priests had called on them to kill without mercy to avenge the destruction of St. Vladimir. Inkerman was a Pyrrhic victory for the British and the French. They had managed to resist the largest Russian effort yet to dislodge them from the heights around Sevastopol, but the casualties were very high, at a level that the public would find hard to tolerate, especially after they learned about the poor treatment of the dying and the wounded by the medical services. Serious questions would be asked about the wisdom of the whole campaign when the news reached home. With such heavy losses, it was no longer feasible for the Allied armies to mount a fresh assault against Sevastopol's defences until fresh troops arrived. At a joint planning conference at Raglan's headquarters on the 7th of November, the French took over from the British on Mount Inkerman, a tacit recognition that they had become the senior partner in the military alliance, leaving the British, now down to just 16,000 effectives, to occupy no more than a quarter of the trenches around Sevastopol. At the same meeting, Canrobert insisted on shelving any plans for an assault against Sevastopol until the following spring, when the Allies would have enough reinforcements to overcome the Russian defences, which had not only withstood the first Allied bombardment, but had been greatly strengthened since. The French commander argued that the Russians had brought in a large number of fresh troops, increasing their numbers in Sevastopol to 100,000 men. In fact, they had barely half that number after Inkerman. He feared that they would be able to go on reinforcing their defences as long as the attitude of Austria with respect to the Eastern question allows Russia to send any number of troops she pleases from Bessarabia and southern Russia to the Crimea. Until the French and British had a military alliance with the Austrians and had brought in very numerous reinforcements to the Crimea, there was no point losing more lives in the siege. Raglan and his staff agreed with Canrobert. The question now was how to make provision for the Allied troops to spend the winter on the heights above Sevastopol, for all they had brought with them were lightweight tents suitable only for summer campaigning. Canrobert believed, and the British shared his view, that by means of a simple stone substructure under tents, the troops might pass the winter here. Rose agreed. "The climate is healthy," he explained to Clarendon, "and with the exception of cold northerly winds, the cold in winter is not vigorous." The prospect of spending the winter in Russia filled many with a dark sense of foreboding. They thought about Napoleon in 1812. De Lacy Evans urged Raglan to abandon the siege of Sevastopol and evacuate the British troops. The Duke of Cambridge proposed withdrawing the troops to Balaclava, where they could be more easily supplied and sheltered from the cold than on the heights above Sevastopol. Raglan rejected their proposals and resolved to keep the army on the heights throughout the winter months, a criminal decision prompting the resignation of Evans and Cambridge, who returned to England, sick and disillusioned, before winter came. Their departure began a steady homeward trail of British officers. In the 2 months after Inkerman, 225 of the 1,540 officers in the Crimea departed for warmer climes. Only 60 of them would return. Among the rank and file, the realization that there would be no quick victory was even more demoralizing. "Why did we not make a bold attack after being flushed with victory at Alma?" asked Lieutenant Colonel Mundy of the 33rd Regiment of Foot. He summed up the general mood in a letter to his mother on the 7th of November. "If the Russians are as strong as they say, we must quit the siege, for it is generally understood that even with our present strength we can do no good with Sevastopol. The fleet is useless, and the work now so harassing that when the cold weather comes on, hundreds must fall victims to overexertion and sickness. Sometimes, not one night rest do the men get in six, and oftentimes are 24 hours on. It must be remembered that they have no clothing except a thin blanket, and the cold and damp are very severe at night, and the constant state of anxiety we are always in, for fear of an attack being made on our trenches, batteries or redoubts, quite puts a stop to calm, wholesome sleep. Rates of desertion from the Allied trenches increased sharply as the winter cold arrived in the weeks after Inkerman, with hundreds of British and French soldiers giving themselves up to the Russian side. For the Russians, the defeat at Inkerman was a devastating blow. Menshikov became convinced that the fall of Sevastopol was unavoidable. In a letter to the Minister of War, Prince Dolgorukov, on the 9th of November, he recommended its abandonment so that Russian forces could be concentrated on the defence of the rest of the Crimea. The Tsar was enraged by such defeatism from his commander-in-chief. "For what was the heroism of our troops and such heavy losses if we accept defeat?" he wrote to Menshikov on the 13th of November. "Surely our enemies have also suffered heavily. I cannot agree with your opinion. Do not submit, I say, and do not encourage others to do so. We have God on our side." Despite such words of defiance, the Tsar was thrown into a deep depression by the news of Inkerman, and his despondent mood was clear for all at court to see. In the past, Nicholas had tried to hide his feelings from his courtiers, but after Inkerman, there was no more concealing it. "The palace at Kachina is gloomy and silent," Tyutcheva noted in her diary. "Everywhere there is depression, people hardly daring to speak to each other. The sight of the sovereign is enough to break one's heart. Recently he has become more and more morose. His face is careworn, and his look is lifeless." Shocked by the defeat, Nicholas lost faith in the commanders who had led him to believe that the war in the Crimea could be won. He began to regret his decision to go to war against the Western powers in the first place, and turned for comfort to those advisers, such as Paskevich, who had always been against the war. "It was a treacherous, revolting business," Tolstoy wrote of the defeat in his diary on the 14th of November. "The 10th and 11th divisions attacked the enemy's left flank. The enemy put forward 6,000 riflemen. Only 6,000 against 30,000, and we retreated, having lost about 6,000 brave men. And we had to retreat because half our troops had no artillery owing to the roads being impassable, and, God knows why, there were no rifle battalions. Terrible slaughter. It will weigh heavy on the souls of many people. Lord forgive them." The news of this action has produced a sensation. "I've seen old men who wept aloud, and young men who swore to kill Dannenberg. Great is the moral strength of the Russian people. Many political truths will emerge and evolve in the present difficult days for Russia. The feeling of ardent patriotism that has arisen and issued forth from Russia's misfortunes will long leave its traces on her. These people who are now sacrificing so much will be citizens of Russia, and we will not forget their sacrifice. They will take part in public affairs with dignity and pride, and the enthusiasm aroused in them by the war will stamp on them forever the quality of self-sacrifice and nobility." Since the retreat of the Russian army from Silistria, Tolstoy had led a comfortable existence in Kishinev, where Gorchakov had set up his headquarters, but he soon grew bored of attending balls and playing cards, at which he lost heavily, and dreamed of seeing action once again. "Now that I have every comfort, good accommodation, a piano, good food, regular occupations, and a fine circle of friends, I have begun to yearn for camp life again, and envy the men out there," Tolstoy wrote to his Aunt Toinette on the 29th of October. Inspired by the wish to do something for his fellow men, Tolstoy and a group of fellow officers thought of setting up a periodical. The Military Gazette, as they called their journal, was intended to educate the soldiers, bolster their morale, and reveal their patriotism and humanity to the rest of Russian society. "This venture of mine pleases me very much," Tolstoy wrote to his brother Sergei. "The journal will publish descriptions of battles, not such dull and untruthful ones as in other journals, deeds of bravery, biographies and obituaries of worthy people, especially the little known. War stories, soldiers' songs, popular articles about the skills of the engineers, etc. To finance the Gazette, which was to be cheap enough for the troops themselves to buy, Tolstoy diverted money from the sale of the family house at Yasnaya Polyana, which he had been forced to sell that autumn to cover his losses at cards. Tolstoy wrote some of his first stories for the periodical, How Russian Soldiers Die and Uncle Zhdanov and the Horseman Chernov, in the second of which he exposed the brutality of an army officer beating a soldier, not for something that he had done wrong, but because he was a soldier, and soldiers must be beaten. Realizing that this would not pass the censor, Tolstoy omitted these two stories before submitting the idea for the periodical to Gorchakov, who sent it on to the War Ministry. But even so, publication was rejected by the Tsar, who did not want an unofficial soldier's paper to challenge Russian Invalid, the government's own army newspaper. The defeat of Inkerman made up Tolstoy's mind to go to the Crimea. One of his closest comrades, Comstadius, with whom he had been planning to edit the Gazette, was killed at Inkerman. More than anything, it was his death that drove me to ask for a transfer to Sevastopol, he wrote in his diary on the 14th of November. He made me feel somehow ashamed. Tolstoy later explained to his brother that his request had been mostly out of patriotism, a sentiment which, I confess, is gaining an increasingly strong hold on me. But perhaps just as important to his decision to go to the Crimea was his sense of destiny as a writer. Tolstoy wanted to see and write about the war, to reveal to the public the whole truth, both the patriotic sacrifice of the ordinary people and the failures of the military leadership, and thereby start the process of political and social reform to which he believed the war must lead. Tolstoy arrived in Sevastopol on the 19th of November, almost 3 weeks after setting out from Kishinev. Promoted to the rank of second lieutenant, he was attached to the 3rd Light Battery of the 14th Artillery Brigade and, to his annoyance, was quartered in the town itself, a long way from the city's defences. Tolstoy stayed only 9 days in Sevastopol that autumn, but he saw enough to inspire much of the patriotic pride and hope in the common Russian people that filled the pages of Sevastopol in December, the first of his Sevastopol sketches, which was to make his literary name. The spirit of the army is beyond all description, he wrote to Sergei on the 20th of November. A wounded soldier, almost dying, told me how they took the 24th French Battery, but weren't reinforced. He was sobbing. A company of marines almost mutinied because they were to be relieved from a battery where they'd withstood bombardment for 30 days. Soldiers extract the fuses from bombs. Women carry water to the bastions and read prayers under fire. In one brigade at Inkerman, there were 160 wounded men who wouldn't leave the front. It's a wonderful time. But now, we've quietened down. It's beautiful in Sevastopol now. The enemy hardly fires at all, and everyone is convinced that he won't take the town, and it really is impossible. There are 3 assumptions. Either he's going to launch an assault, or he's diverting our attention with false earthworks in order to disguise his retreat, or he's fortifying his position for the winter. The first is least likely, and the second most likely. I haven't managed to be in action even once, but I thank God that I've seen these people and am living at this glorious time. The bombardment of the 17th of October will remain as the most brilliant and glorious feat not only in Russian history, but in the history of the world.